Hi everyone and welcome to the Stage Left podcast, and to begin with a quick thanks for your wonderful comments for our episode featuring the legendary Steve Cropper. The word great and legend is overused these days, isn't it? But he's the epitome of those. And if you haven't heard it, Steve talks us through writing Sitting on the Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, playing at the White House for President Barack Obama, and composing and playing on countless hit songs that we well know in your household. So you can hear that at stageleftpodcast.com, where you'll find other episodes featuring the likes of Mike Rowe of Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds and Oasis, Liam and Noel's brother Paul Gallagher speaking in detail about what it's like growing up with Liam and Noel, and Kieran Pepper, the Prodigy. Today we have Aziz Ibrahim in an episode to be released in two parts. So this is part one and features a fascinating and never discussed in detail before chat about his time in the Stone Roses. He also had a guitar in his lap the whole time, which was fantastic. So he plays lots of little examples of how he approached learning John Squire's guitar parts, such as Fool's Gold, On the Resurrection, and so on. Also talks about his upbringing, his influences, joining the band, and his preparation for headlining Reading, his memories of the gig itself, and actually the subsequent fallout, which resulted in death threats and abuse from the press. Part two, which will be available in a couple of weeks, will cover his time as Ian Brown songwriter, cover Ian's arrest, how he composed Corpses in Their Mouths, My Star, and details what it was like working with Paul Weller and Manny on his solo album, and covers loads more. It's a fascinating couple of hours, so we split it over two parts. To keep in the loop, the Stage Left Podcast, follow us on Twitter at the Stage Left Pod, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/the Stage Left Podcast. Get in touch, say hello, and we hope you enjoy this episode. So sit back, relax, and enjoy some magic from the genius that is Aziz Ibrahim.
Somebody else there, but, yeah, I'm all right.
Good stuff. So we're in Longsight, your lifelong hometown. This place means a lot to you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's strange, you know, when you're actually born in the area you grew up in. I was born at home, you see, so you know, it's not just the, yeah, this is where I live, this is where I was born, this is where I, you know, where I was made, so you know, made in Longsight, that's the stamp underneath. So I think everything that I do seems to have that connection, because even the songwriting and the music relates to the area and the influence of the area and the influence of my friends. And so, you know, you look at albums I've released, you know, I've got Lord to Longsight, and I've got Rush on Rock, which is the neighbouring area, but it's actually the postcode that I think we do fall under, Rush on, but the boundaries have moved.
Right.
So, it, whereas it's probably Rushon, but it's considered Longsight.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So I'm M13, but it was actually within the Rushon area.
How's the place changed? How's Longsight changed?
I mean, it's changed hugely in the early days. You know, obviously, I lived in a different house, but I was in a terrace house when I was born, and I was there until 7 years old. Then I moved across to this council estate, the Anson estate in Longsight, M13. And it was, at that time, it was a great time. You know, I mean, the shops were really pretty, I remember. You know, there was like quaint butchers, you know, the stripy kind of materials, and there was the paper shop, and it was really neat and tidy, and all the sweets were in, you know, the correct order and on these fantastic shelves. And you, when you as a kid, you used to ogle over these things and little trinkets and whatnot. And there used to be a toy shop down the road called Joytown, which was like, I suppose, a precursor to Toys R Us.
Right, okay.
But it was actually, you know, just a toy, kind of a toy shop stroke, you know, odds and sods. And there was a guitar hanging in the window, which was like £5. And I remember running and, you know, throwing a little wobbler before my birthday. And my mum and dad bought me this £5 acoustic guitar, which is what I started on.
And how did they feel about you having an interest in music with the guitar? Was the guitar prominent in the music they were listening to?
Oh, they didn't take it seriously. So no. Not a musical family as per se. That you know, like in generations of musicians in Asian culture, that's their forefathers are musicians, but not with my family. My dad was in the army in India, and he came over. He did a journalism course, and he joined the Reuters. And the guy that owned the Reuters in Pakistan, he got my dad a job in Longsight. So my dad took the chance and moved over here. And like I said, at that time, it was predominantly a white area, Irish, English, and it was hard going for him. But the area, you know, it was just growing. Longsight's been through so many phases. I mean, currently it's sort of predominantly Asian now. Kind of Asian, black, Irish, and Bangladeshi. So many mosques have sprung up and so forth. And I've got to say, the area's not as well kept as it used to be. There used to be that kind of community. There is community spirit and pride, but at that time there was a different kind of community spirit. But, you know, it has changed a lot, but that's how it goes.
And when you saw that guitar hanging up in that, was it Joytown?
Joytown.
Why was it who had you seen playing the guitar? Why did you kind of look at that guitar and say, that's something I want to...
Well, it's just straightforward. When I was at primary school, I used to get you a bottle of milk, and my class teacher used to play for us afterwards. He'd pull out this acoustic guitar and play things, and he played this piece, which was like... And I think it could have been Simon and Garfunkel. It reminds me of something off their tunes. And I was just mesmerised by it, and that's why I wanted a guitar, because I was like, I've never seen that before. And especially from the Asian household, all you hear is the sitar, and you hear Bollywood films and Bollywood soundtracks, and or Qawwali and things like that. But for me, the guitar was this just a strange place, and I don't know what it is that's drawn me to it. But everything I do is always atypical Asian Muslim, the breaking the stereotype mold. Not because I choose to. I mean, purposely choose to. It's just by. Just the way I am. I can't explain it. So even the sports I do, I'm a big basketball, rugby buff. They're the things that I love. So it's not cricket and badminton with me, or football. It's always the odd, the opposite direction.
How did your family and parents take to the guitar being played in the household?
You said before, but they never took to the guitar or music in general. They always said, you've got to get a proper job.
Really?
Kind of thing, yeah.
You're under that pressure, yeah?
Oh, yeah, always, yeah. Most Asian kids are under that pressure. You've got to be a doctor, nurse, accountant, a lawyer.
How did that affect you?
It was a constant struggle, because I just felt, drawn to the instrument. And, my mum and dad, beautiful people, they were always supportive. I mean, they bought me for my first guitar, but obviously objecting. I wrote that song Marassi, which is the first instrumental I ever did, and that was actually a piece I wrote for my dad. In fact, my whole music and lyrics have been geared towards convincing him that music is, a great thing. It's a beautiful thing. Currently I do a lot of music therapy, and I've been working at that and trying to discover what the connection is between, the soul as such, and the head and the brain and music, and what it does for people, how it kind of brings people together.
And do you think you were trying to prove something to them, that you could either make a career out of the music industry, or was it that you were trying to prove that you were good at the guitar?
I think I wasn't trying to prove, because I just found that I had a talent for it. I mean, it's not being big-headed, but I found I had a talent for it, that I could pick it up very quickly. First things, a lot of people learn the things like I play, and that was probably the first thing I ever learned, just because it was a couple of notes and one string, and then started learning the power chords and bar chords, that kind of, power chords. So I started learning these things, picking up really fast, and then by the time I was 12, I was probably playing in the local pub with a rockabilly band, and, we'd be playing those kind of Elvis things. or, you know, I don't know, shadows and the...
Yeah. Was there a bigger rockabilly scene in Manchester? Because you're the second person we've now had on.
Another Mancunian
guitar legend. Paul Gallagher, Liam Noel's brother, said that Noel was a rockabilly when he was a young, like, really into rockabilly music and stuff like that.
Was he?
So I just wondered, like, was there a big scene in, around rockabilly?
I mean, I don't know. I didn't know Newport at the time, but there was. I used to play, you know, the clubs around, like, Longside had a club called the Shanty.
Right.
Which burned down, but they used to have punk nights and they used to have rockabilly nights and reggae nights.
Mm.
And it was the same in Mossad and Hume. So they were always played, and the pubs were always, you know, we had a double bass player, you know, everyone had a quiff and all that. No crepes or shoes, but I wasn't a teddy boy, you know, it was rockabilly, so...
You once said that the guitar was like a symbol of rebellion. Now, you don't. You said obviously you don't drink and don't smoke. Looking back, what were you rebelling against?
Well, that was my symbol of rebellion, you know. For some people, it might be, you know, a woman without a veil or something. I don't know. But for me, you know, because I have that life, it's inhibited in a way because of the restrictions of the religion, faith, community pressure, peer pressure. And the instrument, for some reason, gave me that release of energy and expression. It's mainly the expression that, you know, it was just... I don't know, you know, when you're playing it, it's like, you know, there's something in it that just makes me feel alive and I can say what I want to say with it. And then it's back to the normality of, okay, life outside the house is different, you know, because the mates I was hanging out with, I mean, we're getting in a lot of trouble, you know, like some of them are inside now, even to this day, or turned to drugs and things like that. And the guitar, again, even though it was rebellious, it was something that gave me a focus for my energy to keep me on the straight and narrow. And I wrote this song, The Middle Road, which my dad used to give me a lecture about, you know, stay on the middle road, stay on the straight and narrow path. And
it's a great tune, man. I know. Yeah, it's a good tune. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it comes from those things. Growing up in Longside, seeing my friends incarcerated and the lectures my mum and dad used to give me, which were confusing because I was born here, you know, second generation, you have two lives, outside with your mates and you have the life at home. It's a very, you know, it's a real contrast, you know.
Fascinating.
I mean, 1 minute's like... two. You know, the two things are just complete contrast to each other.
Awesome. What is it, you talked about the you listened to a lot of kind of Eastern or Asian music as well at the time. What advantage did having an understanding of Asian music give you when writing in bands with more of a Western slant? Because obviously the scales are very contrasting. Did that give you an advantage in any way?
I mean, it gave me an advantage because I think as a second generation Asian here, you have, if you choose, you can have the strengths of both worlds. I mean, you can pick the weaknesses if you want, but, you know, if you've got any sense, you'll pick the strengths of. And both cultures are rich, you know, in heritage, and kind of drew on both of them. But I don't know what it is with my mindset. I was looking for a route to how to incorporate what I have in my own heritage, my family heritage, into music so that it could work in a songwriting kind of way. So I started to learn or teach myself by, you know, teach myself really, that's how I've always been, my own research, how I could take something as simple as playing, you know, you've got a progression which is, let's say this, I might be playing something like that, and I think, how can I use something, you know, Eastern, which isn't really, I'm not trying to play Indian classical music or something, but how can I put it into a song? So I'd take the scale and the rag and I'd go, and then switch back.
Yeah. Thank you.
American ways how to incorporate it, but in a songwriting capacity, because it's like it just became a style. And like any great players, and you know, writers like, you know, Jimmy Page or whoever it is, or they kind of had a way of playing to the song as opposed to playing music for musicians. It was for the songwriting. So that's how I've always approached it. So I try to enrich my knowledge about, you know, these ragas and things like that, and other countries as well, you know, whether it's from Korea, Japan, China, or South America, and just pick up the not just the notes, but I'd also study the instrument and how it's played. So if it's a kind of, you know, it's a rhythmical solo, yeah, rhythmical way of playing. I've always been a rhythm player, and I'd try to play like that also, and that started to create this style of my own, really, where my rhythm hand is as equally important as me being able to, you know, most people go, you know, that's not important to me. They're just running scales and things, but how you play it and the melody and the rhythm and the timing, especially, because I mean, classical music has, Indian classical, it's rich in mathematical timing, to be able to play, you know, in odd time signatures. But I would write songs in odd time signatures, so it'd be like thinking rock, and going. Things like that. That's Rupak Thal, which is a 7-beat cycle. Right. But I'm not thinking about the, I'm more thinking how I can use that, how I can utilize it into a song, and make people feel like it's a song, and not think about the mathematics and think about, oh, that's clever.
Yeah.
I just want them to think about the words and the lyrics and the melody. Yeah.
Fantastic. So. I think you were 22 years old when you got the dream job, as you described it, of playing in Simply Red.
Was that, dream job?
Yeah. what do you remember about getting that call, and how did that come about? So how did you go from playing in rockabilly bands to playing in Simply Red, who were a big band at the time, weren't they?
God, I can't even remember a Simply Red tune now. It was 1987. I mean, I can remember... That's about all I can remember. It was 1987, and I got a phone call at home here in Longsight, and it was literally, I think it was the manager, Andy Dodds, or Elliot Rashman, and they rang and said, how would you like to join Simply Red, and we're on a world tour, and we'll pay you $1,000 a week or something, and whatever, you know, 5-star first class. And I was like, is that you, Delroy, messing around? Stop it, man. And all that kind of thing. So, I mean, I didn't even know the music. So I was... But then when I said, I'll have to get back to you about it.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, I'm not sure, you know, because I didn't know who it was.
Yeah.
So I had to do a bit of research, and then I spoke to them next time. I took it because it was the same thing, you know. I wasn't going to follow the route of, am I going to be a doctor? I mean, that was the aim, really, medicine. Am I going to be a doctor? But that fate was there staring me in the face saying, why not a musician? You can play. I never thought about it as a career. And 1987, that day was the first time I ever considered music as a career. I mean, I was playing basketball. I loved basketball more than I did music. And but I took it, and it's led me down this crazy route. You know, the bands and groups and things that you've never even heard of, actually, all that places that I've been, and it's just unbelievable journey, and I wouldn't change that for anything.
Is it right you turned up to the rehearsals with Simply Red with an ice pink Ibanez and they didn't like it?
That's very true, yeah. I was in an Ibanez mode at the time, you know, speed metal, rock. I was in that, you know, I was heavily into Metallica and stuff.
Yeah. How did it go down when you turned up with that? Is it right they gave you a PR signature to play instead? Is that right?
No, they. Okay, what happened? I mean, when I first met Mick, I mean, it was a strange meeting. I mean, the first thing he asked me was, "Do you like curry?" I was like,
"Really?"
I was looking at myself thinking, does this guy not get it? You know, my name's Aziz Ibrahim and I'm Pakistani, and he's asking me if I like Korean. So anyway, I said yeah, 21 or something at the time, 22 or whatever. And I just kind of, he looked at the guitar, and they'd obviously had a discussion and said, no, that guitar's going to have to go. And I said, well, this is what I can afford. If you want me to play another guitar, you're going to have to pay for it. So they gave me a wad of money and said, go out shopping. And the manager at the time, Elliot Rashman, he was giving it the big I am as well. You know, I'm the manager and I can sort everything out for you. And he bought me a load of suits, you know, they were all wearing fancy suits at the time. And he bought me about 5 or 6 Italian suits, all, you know, all Japanese, or real top brands, you know, Yoji Yamamoto.
Nice, yeah.
And some Phil Smith, I think I'd deal with Phil Smith at the time. Or, and some Thierry Mugler and... some all manner of suits, you know, some fantastic brands. Anyway, so they gave me a wad of money and I went down to London and I went to Chandler's and met Doug Chandler down there. And it was actually the first time I met Paul Stacey, who writes with Oasis.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Like, works with the Black Crowes and stuff. And Paul sold me a this PRS signature, which actually today is worth a whole heap of money.
Still got it?
Particular model. No. It wasn't for me at the time.
Right.
It was a beautiful guitar, but there were some inherent problems for me anyway. But it was a beautiful guitar and it sounded great. And they bought me this 2 grand guitar, and they bought me a fantastic Paul Rivera head, amplifier head, which was rack mounted, and bought me 2 Marshall cabs, 4x12s, which they removed the Marshall logos from.
Why?
Well, I turned up one day at, we were at somewhere like Canada or somewhere and on tour. Excuse me. And it was just one of the days. I came in for a sound check and there were silver Jubilee cabs, so they were kind of grey silver colour. And the Marshall logos had gone, and I said, what's the crack? What's going down? And they said, oh, Mick doesn't like the rock connotations of the Marshall logo, so he had them taken off. You know, it was the beginning of the end, yeah. And needless to say, you know, I'd left by the following year.
Really? Yeah. What do you remember of those gigs, though? I mean, is it difficult?
They were beautiful shows, you know. Yeah. I mean, it was the first time I'd actually played stadiums.
That's what I was going to say. How did that affect you? How did you approach going from playing?
You know what? The only thought in my head was, what a beautiful country, what a beautiful race. It was in Brazil at the time.
Wow.
São Paulo and Rio. And São Paulo Football Stadium, I was looking out at this beautiful crowd of, you know, multiracial kind of society, and chocolate to light skin and,
yeah,
to, you know, all manner. It was just beautiful. And all I could think was, I wish my mum and dad were here.
Oh,
that's,
yeah,
all I was thinking. And then it's so strange, you know, to stand there, you've got something like 150,000 people all screaming and shouting, and you're rubbing shoulders. At that time, it was the 80s, so we were rubbing shoulders, UB40 and Duran Duran and Robert Palmer and Pretenders and Simple Minds. They were all on the lineup. It was Rockin' Rio or something like that. But
yeah, yeah.
And for me, you know, I just felt like, what am I doing here? Kid from Longside, you know, Council Estate, Anson Estate, and stood on this stage.
What advice would you give to young musicians if they get thrown into doing some big stadium gigs for the first time? What'd you do with that nervous energy on the day? You don't strike me as someone who gets very nervous, but what'd you do on that day?
I have my moments.
You have your moments.
You know, it's just natural, it's normal, you know, to feel nervous at times. I mean, you probably feel more nervous on a date than you do on stage, but you know. Advice, you know, I don't know if I'm the one for giving advice. I can only talk about experience, you know.
Yeah.
And generally, it's like, I seem to have 2 lives, like I said. You know, there's a whole population of the world that maybe look at me and say, want to know what it's like to play, excuse the expression, in a white man's world.
Right.
And they kind of say, you know, what's that like and how do you cope? And I can say advise on that and say, you know, this, you got to take a chance, you just got to put out, you got to be, you know, just go for it. Don't regret your life, don't look back and say I wish I had, you know, the life's for the living. And when what that means is fill the moments with the things that you want to do.
Mm.
And that's what I've done. I filled my life with what I wanted to do. Selfish as it sounds, I believe you should fulfill yourself as a human being and not wake up each day thinking, I hate this job, or I hate being here, or I hate this relationship, whatever. Just go for it and do what your heart tells you. Your instincts, rely on them. And be that person that you can be, whether you're man or woman, boy or girl, you know, you can be that person. If I can, that's what I can say. I'm a Pakistani Muslim from Longsight, you know, from poverty. And it's like, if I can be what, you know, achieve what I've achieved, I'm sure that there's people with far greater advantages than me that could do 10 times as well as I did.
Yeah.
I'm just showing, giving you an idea that things are possible. And that's the best advice I can give, you know.
Talk us through, because after you left Simply Red, one job that you did, I think you were MD, musical director for Earl Brown's Hot Chocolate.
God rest his soul.
Yeah.
He's a lovely guy, lovely family.
What does that entail? What does that entail, the musical director job? What are you doing there for a musician?
In those days, I mean, it was coming out of Simply Red, so those kind of titles existed, you know, musical director, session player, so forth. I mean, I was just... I was just a lad looking for a band, looking to be in a band. But obviously to feed myself and stay in music full time, I'd take the session work. And I got offered the work here in Manchester, but I had to go down to London to meet Errol through his agent. And he wanted to go back out on the road. And I put the band together.
Right, okay.
And I arranged the music and then started rehearsing and booked the studios and arranged the music with the band that I put together.
And what's your working relationship with Errol then? Is he kind of the decision maker and he leaves you to do it, or are you telling him this is how
it's a really easygoing guy. He just wants to feel right, you know. He wanted to feel right in his music, and I just wanted to honour his music, because Hot Chocolate were a band. Each member contributed in their own way to the sound of Hot Chocolate. I mean, I discovered this when I had to learn the guitar parts, and it wasn't just, you know,
classic.
Yeah, but it wasn't just,
no,
hey, I played the line. It was the same thing as the Roses. I had to respect for the music, respect for the songwriter, to discover how the sound of the instruments created.
Mm.
And they were classic. The guy on guitar used an old, I think it was an old Roland guitar synthesizer and the old Les Paul style guitar synthesizer, right, to create those tones. If you listen closely to Everyone's a Winner and You Sexy Thing and Emmeline and It Started with a Kiss and so on, you know, there are very unique sounds on guitar, and I had so much more respect after that, you know, discovering how created the sound.
Yeah, so it's your job then to work out, right, so that's how it sounded on the record. We've now got replica.
I'm anal about these things. I want to learn what was the equipment used. I want to know how the tone was created. I want to know the chords that he was using. I want to know was the era of instrument that he was using, what the pickups were. I want to analyze it to death to learn the secrets of rock and roll, to learn the secrets of songwriting and music. And it was the same with the Roses, you know. I kind of wanted to learn how John Squire created his tone, how he created those chords, whether he was capoing, whether it was this guitar, whether it was the ES-345 or it was the Strat, or was it the Jaguar, was it the Gretsch, was it the Mesa Boogie, was it the Fender Twins? And then I inherited this equipment, the Roses, as well. So I still got some of the old Roses.
You see, you've got a bass outside.
I've got the basses, and there's some guitars, and you know, I inherited the ES-345, the 1959 ES-3, which is on the Love Spreads video. And
right,
I had the 59 Les Paul for a while on tour, which was beautiful, and another Les Paul which I used for Love Spreads, which is quite heavy, but it was custom. It was a very custom made guitar made by a certain Gibson luthier. There's a Japanese guy, I forgot his name, but anyway, he had an unmatched top. Then there's there were the Strats, the pink Strats, or the Resurrection Strat, we call it, and the 59 Strat, and the 62, 64 Strat. You know, there were various instruments which kind of inherited. Some I have, and some I haven't, but the bass was important. because I write from bass guitar, you see.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and okay. That's how I wrote most of Unfinished Monkey Business and Golden Great stuff.
Really?
And, yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah, because I was going to actually come on to Roses. I wonder, from a musician's point of view again, if you could break down how you actually worked out the parts that John played. So you're talking about the equipment and that kind of thing. Is that done by ear, or are you watching stuff?
Completely by ear. At that time, you know, there wasn't a lot to watch in the 90s, unless you had your VHS on at the right time, and they were actually on. And yeah, you could watch the Roses on, you know, Granada Reports or something, or you know, one of those programs they'd been on, you know, amateurs and all that, you know. Or but it was hard to get a glimpse into what pedals were being used, because he had his Boss pedals. And I mean, you know that it changed from the first album to the second album. The tone changed, the sound changed. So looking at the way John was evolving as a musician, and his probable Jimmy Page influence, yeah, the Les Pauls came out, and the Marshalls, and the style of playing, there was a lot more kind of Jimmy Page-esque, you know. You know, the kind of hammer and pull off things. And he was evolving as a player, learning new things. And he was, I don't know whether he was coming from a kind of a Simon and Garfunkel phase of the chords and so forth. And but listening to it, I didn't know there wasn't a capo involved, and there was a capo involved
on Waterfall. He played with a capo on the fourth fret, and
that's
then I saw coverage of you playing it the other day, and you haven't got a capo on. So did you? So and that looked a lot harder.
Yeah.
You know,
like, I mean, I'm not even sure I can remember what I did, but I mean, obviously the fourth fret is there.
Yeah,
and we're on. That's what I did. So I went. Which is something. Yeah, it's probably that I just didn't know, so I just got on with it.
Yeah.
But it was a voyage of discovery, you know. I learned so much from John's parts and the Roses albums. It completely changed me. And then I switched instruments to Gibsons, Gretsches, Fenders, anything classy, and Rickenbackers. And it was an evolution for me through learning the Roses songs and learning John's parts, because again, like I said, I got anal about the equipment and things and trying to replicate out of respect for the fans and out of respect for him. I was trying to do the music justice, because I mean, I was oblivious to the fact. I mean, I know Noel says it was the hardest job in the world, but to me, I didn't think it was, because I wasn't in that frame of mind. I wasn't a Roses fan, but I realised afterwards, obviously, there was a love and there was a backlash. You know, I could never replace John Squire, and that the message I got. And I mean, I was kind of high as well, in the terms of a natural high, and wow, I'm in the greatest band in the world here. And the homage and the tributes from other bands, and I was getting support from the Asian community, and you know, get in there, lad. And it was a great time. And then at the same time, you know, I was getting death threats, I was getting all manner of, you know, abuse from people, racist abuse, and it was a great time, and it wasn't a great time. But I learned a lot. I learned so much. I grew up. I mean, I got a lot of abuse from the press, real abuse, and they were merciless from the start to finish. And they kind of painted the picture like history gets painted in a specific way. You know, the West paints a history and the East paints its own history. And it was like that. The press kind of pasted a history and said, this is what it was. 96, Reading was this, and that, that. You know, talking about Ian singing out a tune. But then if you watch Ian on previous performances, you'll find he drifts in and out. You know, some gigs
are good. He does even now.
Some gigs are bad. Yeah. His voice has changed through, you know, smoking or whatever, you know, and it's just kind of, you know, people change. We get older, and
but there wasn't much criticism of your performance in that gig. I think
there was a lot of criticism. I read
really of yourself, yeah.
Yeah, I saw so much stuff, and it was really abuse. I mean, I even had people saying that I couldn't play.
That's rubbish. I watched it this week. You're fine, well, man. Like, Ian's off at times, but you know, you're.
I mean, I can look at it, and honestly, analyze the thing and say, yeah, we made a mistake. Well, when I say we, I mean, I was just concentrating on trying to get the parts right and trying to fit in and make sure that the music was delivered the way it should be. I was oblivious to what was going on around me. You know, there was a dancer on stage, and in all honesty, thinking, looking at it, seeing the video, I'm thinking, well, yeah, we made a mistake there.
Whose idea was that?
We had a piano and we had Hammond. I mean, I don't want to name any names.
Oh, okay, fine, yeah, fair enough.
But it kind of, there was, you know, we had a Hammond and piano, and it kind of took over in the mix, and I had no idea why that is, because it made it sound more karaoke than anything. So there were kind of errors there that, you know, we could have avoided.
In your press conference when you first joined the band, you stated that you wanted to give Roses an Indian influence. How do you think that would have played out? What would a third Stone Roses album would have sounded like?
Oh gosh, you know, when I think back to that time, you know, I was a bit of an idiot. I mean, I feel a bit of an idiot at the time, because like I said, I was just on a natural high. You get somebody, you know, it's like Simply Red phoning you up at the 21 or something, or but the Roses phoning you up, you know, in 1996. It was like, I was so happy. I was over the moon, and I was just talking, as they say, talking out my ass, as far as I'm concerned. And I was talking about Indian influence. I was just trying to say something that, look, I know this is the ultimate band, and there's no one that can replace any member in this band. But I just wanted to bring something to the table which was original, and it was the reason why Manny and Ian took to me, I think, musically speaking, never mind friendship, but they saw that there was a future in maybe something new, because this kid could bring something different, which wasn't John, it was himself. And if we could bring it into the songwriting, which I did eventually in the Ian Brown solo albums, and it wasn't an Asian influence per se, where each track was all of a sudden completely Indian classical.
No, it
was all about the songs.
Yeah.
So I'd learnt songwriting through, obviously, hanging out with Ian.
And so did you already, so what was the relationship with the boys before you joined the band? Were you friends with Ian for many years?
I didn't have one.
Right, okay. So they, how did they find you?
I was only, I'm Robbie Maddox. He called me, said they were demoing songs, and would I help, because there wasn't a guitarist. They just said that John was away, or, you know, he wasn't sure where he was, so they were demoing songs. So I just stepped into demo songs, and that's how I met Ian and Manny. And built a friendship then. And then I got a call months after saying, John's not coming back, and would I be interested? But I think there had been auditions. Because, well, I know there had been auditions. Slash had offered. Slash had offered to play. I think there was this kind of...
Really?
Yeah, what had happened is there was a lot of bitterness. There was a lot of kind of, you know... anger and so forth, and they wanted to piss him off, so they decided, let's get the greatest rock icon of all time. Slash was in England, he was at Snake Pit, he'd offered, the management knew the Roses, they wanted to manage the Roses, Goldstein wanted to manage the Roses, so Slash had offered, I think it was Manny or Ian, I'm not sure, one of them said, when they afterwards, they thought, yeah, we'll get this guy in, you know, the big rock icon, that really annoyed John. But then they thought about it and thought, and said something to the effect of, nah, we're not going to work with a guy who wears leather pants, are we? So Slash wasn't in. And then he tried Kelly from Girls, I think it was Kelly. I can't remember her name. She was in Girls School.
Right.
And they thought, get a girl.
Yep.
Great player, that, you know, that'll annoy John. And that never happened. And then, you know, from Atlanta, Georgia to alongside Manchester, the links and the kind of natural feel of me fitting into the band, it just happened in a natural way, and it was in the lyrics, it was in, just happened, you know, again, fate.
What do you remember of those first rehearsals? So I know you said you had a couple of kind of
difficult
filled in. Yeah?
I mean, it wasn't so much learning the parts, because John writes quite, I wouldn't say simple, but he writes... beautiful parts you can remember. So when I was learning, you know, when I was learning, you know, all those chords, you can see they follow melody and chord at the same time. I know they're overdubs, but it's quite easy to do things like that. And you can remember every single line, you know. I could just remember him just purely out of the melody of the songs, of him being able to whistle the tune. So in that respect, it was easy. It was the tones that were hard.
That was right.
It was achieving the sounds and the manner that he plays. Like any artist, especially an individual artist like him, it's very difficult to reproduce every nuance of a man's character or a woman's character. You know, it's the most difficult thing in the world to do that.
Yeah. Oh, man, I think you did a solid job. And
people do for, you know, like Hendrix, because everyone, but it's not the same. It's still not the same.
When you joined, did you feel it was like a poison chalice, or did you genuinely believe that it was going to go on for years and years, that band, looking back?
Well, I was naive. You know, I wouldn't know what was going through Manny's mind, you know, no. When he joined Primals, all these intentions too. And then being the new kid on the, you know, in the band, I wasn't aware. I was completely confused. I thought there was longevity, but in a sense, I was relieved afterwards in 97. I was relieved because I thought I was never going to be allowed to really, it was always going to be a comparison, you know, with John, and never be given a fair chance. So when the Ian Brown solo albums came about, that was my opportunity to actually begin to show people what I could do.
So there we go. That was part one. And thanks for listening. Part two will be available in 2 weeks from now. If you get over to facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast or follow us on Twitter at @thestageleftpod, you'll see when I upload the new episode. And that will cover time. Aziz's time as Ian Brown songwriter, which is really, really fascinating. He actually plays us through how he composed really like classic songs such as Corpses and My Star. Talks about what it was like playing with and recording with Paul Weller. In a lot of detail, what it's like working with Manny, Rennie, and we talk a lot about Aziz's solo stuff, which is fucking amazing. So that's part one. Part two will be available in a couple of weeks. So get over to Facebook and Twitter and you'll see when a new episode is uploaded. Cheers.